The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
All right. Welcome, Joe Fried, back on the TLU podcast with a whole bunch of new experiences in the past year. You've been learning constantly to continue the mission of, you know, honestly, helping people become better lawyers, but more specifically, better trucking lawyers. So this is great stuff, Joe.
I would go the other way, say trucking lawyers and more, and but really just being better lawyers. I mean, we created an environment for us to do that, a platform for us to do that. I remember us talking about this way before COVID, and look at what this has grown into. I'm so proud of what it is. I hear from people all the time how it's making a difference for them. So congratulations on what you've built. You should be proud of it.
Well, I appreciate that. We've all built together. I get the privilege of being kind of like the conductor of an orchestra.
Of people who don't want to play together, right? You got to get a little better at this. No, I'm teasing. I'm seriously, and you know, this isn't supposed to be a Dan Ambrose accolades moment, but for people who don't know, watch the level of commitment and work that you've put in to get to where this is. And it's been, this wouldn't be where it is without that amazing work and an effort to constantly get better and better. Not only with the materials that go in, programming that goes in, but the whole setup. I just wanted to publicly say what a great job I think you're doing with this stuff.
You're going to really experience it in person come June 2nd. You wait and see, but that's for another conversation. But right now, Joe, you've had a pretty active year, as you always do, because, you know, it doesn't matter where you're at. You're always pushing to get better. And so I know you tried a case recently in Virginia. So give us a little bit about that case and what it was about and the things that we learned.
First of all, you know, crazy year, yes. I mean, literally starting the second half of last year, it was literally back-to-back trial calendars, and it was back-to-back cases that would get all the way up to days before trial, even morning of trial, and then resolving. It was absolutely nuts. We'll talk about one of those results after we talk about this, but everything led up to then finally a case, actually one of the ones I wasn't sure would go to trial, does go to trial, which I know people who are trial lawyers understand. The ones you think you're going to try, you don't try. The ones you don't think you're going to try, you end up having to try. So the Virginia case was an interesting case, a wrongful death case of a 17-year-old boy, really nice young man. The case went to trial in Newport News. The basic facts are a tractor trailer driver stops his truck in front of a Popeyes to run inside ostensibly because he had to go to the bathroom like urgently. So he leaves his truck out front. And it's a three-lane road. He turns his flashers on, runs inside. Along comes, meanwhile, the school lets out for the day. A carload of young kids driving home from school in a BMW. And you can probably already tell where this is going to go. But a young driver, inexperienced driver, ends up hitting the rear corner of the trailer that's parked there. Our client was a passenger in the rear of that car. The trailer came in right sort of almost through the rear window, through the rear side window, and took him out. The challenge in the case was that under Virginia law, sort of there's this big difference between negligence. From a causation perspective, for a vehicle that stopped on a roadway, it can be deemed not the cause of a crash. It can be deemed a condition. There was a lot of pretrial stuff that had to do with that. We got through all that stuff. And ultimately, the defense in the case, which was to obviously blame the young driver of the car and to say that they owned that they were negligent in parking where they parked. They said their driver shouldn't have parked in front of Popeyes. Not the cause of the crash. The cause of the crash, 100%. This kid who happened to not be licensed and that came into trial and was inexperienced and was probably driving too fast and, you know, dot, dot, dot. That was what the whole case was really about. They focused on the driver of the car. We focused on just trying to say truck driver can't illegally and improperly park like that and have zero responsibility.
I think I understand clearly the truck's parked on the side of the road in front of a Popeyes.
We won the liability case. We didn't end up getting the numbers that we wanted in the case. And I think there are two reasons for that. And well, first, any questions about the facts? I didn't do a great job laying them out, but he's actually in the road. He's actually in one of three lanes. So he's not on the shoulder. He's actually in the lane.
Just objectively, it sounds like a challenging case that I think most people probably would have passed on because of, even with the technical violation, there's so much, seems like so much contributory fault on the part of the driver. But I don't know what the, you know, separation is in Virginia as far as that goes.
The other thing that made it challenging is this is a road that there are businesses on, and sometimes people do stop to make deliveries at these businesses and things along those lines. So long straight away, you know, all those kind of things. There were definitely challenges in the case, although I really felt like we could win the liability side, and we did win the liability side. There was a lot of comparative fault. Remember, we've got a passenger in the car, so that helped us a lot. But there was a lot of focus on the idea that our young passenger got into a vehicle with somebody who was unlicensed and some things along those lines. So they were fighting liability. They were fighting causation on a number of fronts, but that was the main thing.
So for the 17-year-old young man who died, how did you think about telling the jury what number, what's the value of this young man's life?
Yeah, so that's where it became interesting. And sometimes you learn things at trial you wish you had known before trial. You know what I mean by that? I know from your old, especially from your old criminal defense days, I'm sure you learn some things every now and then during trial, you know, from your old trial days, right? You try to avoid that. And that's what discovery is supposed to be all about. But we learned some things about our case that I wish I'd known before. The biggest one was that I knew the mom was 40 years old at the time of the crash. And she had what I thought to be a beautiful relationship with her son, although it was not typical. I mean, she was a single mom. She had had him when she was young. She had had lots of challenges growing up herself, lots of challenges in relationship. So he almost was like her friend and her son. And he was the one who kind of had the ability to pull her out of dark places, if that makes sense, because she would go to dark places. And I thought that that was a beautiful story. And it would have been, had that been the whole story. We had a lot of problems in the case. And I think this is a warning sign for anybody. When we went to family members and asked them if they would testify, we got a very lukewarm and negative response in terms of, well, we just don't want to be involved. We just don't feel like we're the right people to talk about this. In hindsight, it was a giant red flag, you know, because so many of our cases, and this is whether it's trucking or anything else, they're built on the backs of lay witnesses, not expert witnesses. They're actually built on the backs of your before and after witnesses and people who can speak to relationships and things along those lines. And in this case, you know, we knew we were having challenges with that, but there was this beautiful story. And, you know, that story was developed through psychodramatic techniques and using, you know, psychodramatists and others to build it out. The problem is that it was worse than that. And actually, we had people who from the family who ended up testifying for the defense in the case about the challenges in the relationship between the mom and the son. I think that, I mean, obviously, it did tremendous damage to, we asked for like $30 million or something like that on the death case. And we'll talk about your question in a moment. I would not have asked for the numbers that I had asked for had I known that. An example was after we presented that, you know, the kid was 17 years old. He had a girlfriend. Sometimes he wouldn't stay at home. He would be with the girlfriend and the mom allowed that to happen. Those kind of things, which we really didn't think were a big deal. We thought that was sort of the extent of the challenges in that. But a family member testified that the son actually lived with him more than with the mom and really did a lot of damage, basically had very little good to say about the mom. And literally, that's what came out. And it came out through the defense as witnesses who are family members of ours. So all of that is to kind of give you a flavor for why the case went sideways. And I blame myself for not knowing, because as whoever is the lead in a case has the responsibility of doing that. We did the right things in terms of talking to people and trying to get them on board with us. We should have done more, in my opinion. We did not appreciate intrafamilial challenges in the case. And I think we could have done a better job with that, frankly. You know, so had we known those challenges, I wouldn't have asked for as big a number as I did for Virginia. In Virginia, those numbers are really, really high, asking for $30 million in a death case. In fact, at the mediation of the case, I remember talking to the mediator about, I'm not sharing anything confidential from the mediation. I just want to make sure that's clear. But I remember, I'm always concerned about that because I had a case in Florida. We tried the case and one of my associates at the time got on a podcast like this and talked about what happened at mediation. And the defense filed a motion to vacate the verdict. There was some peculiar law that says if you violate confidentiality, it can vacate a verdict. I ended up having to testify in front of a judge and all this stuff. Thankfully, we survived that. But I'm very sensitive to the reason I'm bringing this up is because I think it's a teaching point for people. You know, a lot of times you've heard me say before that I think we're stuck in paradigms on value, right? And a lot of times what happens is that becomes self-perpetuating. So you're in a state like Virginia, where historically the numbers are low, but the numbers stay low because people ask for low numbers in those. What I have told mediators in the past often is when they come back and they say, nobody gets those kind of numbers here in X, Timbuktu, in this case, Virginia. What my response is, are there cases that are going to trial where those kind of numbers are being asked for? If there are cases where somebody's asking for $30, $50 million and they're not getting it, I may need to listen to that. But if nobody is asking for that, if they're asking for $5 million in a wrongful death case, then of course they're not getting 30, right? And so I challenge mediators, show me actual trial results where people have asked for big numbers, and that's going to be persuasive to me. If you don't have that, then you telling me that this community doesn't produce those kind of numbers isn't really all that influential to me, because I think that the plaintiff's bar, largely because of what all of us have done collaboratively, has gotten really good at asking for big numbers. That's why there are big numbers, especially post-COVID. So going back to your question in this particular case, what I was looking to do in Virginia in this case, and the reason that I agreed to try this one, is I wanted to try to break this paradigm of numbers in Virginia, you know, in cases like this, you know, where they were saying, you know, literally $1 to $2 million is what happens in these kinds of cases. If you can get to $2-2.5 million, you settle these cases. I was like, you know what? Somebody other than the defense and mediator and an insurance company is going to have to say that to me. In this case, it turned out to be right. We still beat their numbers by about $1 million from the offers and things, but it was not anywhere near where I wanted the case to go. At the same time, given the challenges that came out during trial, hell, I would have settled the case for those numbers had I known those issues. So we all learn, right, in trials. And I think that for me, I got a lot of congratulations after from a lot of people saying, wow, in that case, you did great. And I felt like crap because I thought we wanted to do a lot better. And we wanted to do better not only for the mom and this family, but we wanted to do better for Virginia. You know, we wanted to be able to show if you go and you ask for the right numbers, you'll go and get bigger numbers. You know, you live to fight another day. And I hope to do that in Virginia and another opportunity.
If you're in Virginia, you're listening to this, and you got a good trucking case that you might need some assistance on, this could be the test case for Joe to get the 20 or 30 and help you get it. So that'd be great. I'm sure people would be happy about that too.
Sharif Gray, who's going to be out at TLU, got a really nice verdict.
I know.
He's one to watch. He's a really great lawyer and a super guy. You know, so if you don't know him, he's somebody, look for an opportunity to get to know him.
Yeah, he's only been doing it for a few years. You know, he's really learned fast. Put to use what he's learned, because his first TLU, I think, was in 2022, because I think Claggett bought him a scholarship or something like that and brought him out there. And so that's only 4 years. That's pretty good, you know, to learn that fast. And I think like a $20 million verdict or something on that sex abuse case. And then he did a webinar on it. So, and he's also presenting on it at TLU Beach. So
I'm going to try to, if he's presenting at a time when I can get away from one of my presentations, I told him I'd poke my head in and give him some accolades because I think really highly of him. He's definitely an up and comer. He loves trial. So he's trying cases. So huge respect for that young man.
And he even did a conference out there in Virginia and brought you and Eric Gerard and a few other folks out there to present at it. So, and Kenny Berger.
Yeah, he did a great job. He put together really a very heartfelt program where people rolled up their sleeves and got into it pretty quickly. You know, I mean, it was pretty deeply is what I should have said.
Wish I could have made it. Now, so what was the final result of that trial, the final verdict?
I think we got 2.4 million on it. And I think that's right. 2.3 or 2.4 or right between that.
And then most they'd offer you beforehand was like 1.5 million or something like that.
Yeah. And that was even soft. That was kind of a soft offer. Like we could get it done in this range. You know, all the way up until trial, the numbers were south of 1 million that were being offered. So it kind of felt like it felt easy, like what they held back from me. And I give the trial lawyer on the other side a lot of credit. I mean, she had the family members in her pocket and I didn't know.
Yeah, you had no choice. So even though you didn't get what you want.
You know, so it was one of those things where I kept asking myself, and I'm sure other lawyers have had this experience where, what am I missing, right? Like, what am I missing? Well, I was missing something. So that was that.
What are you missing here? Those sneaky defense lawyers not showing all their cards beforehand, give you full information.
I think that in a state like Virginia, they're more emboldened. They just haven't had a lot of big numbers come out. Kind of, they're bold on it. That's right. It was. It lined up.
Because that was a tough case, that case you got that verdict on.
it lined up really well. And if people don't know that story, they should listen to them. There's a lot to learn from it. The bigger question that you ask is how do you look at damages in these cases? And you've heard me say this before, and others have too. When you get to non-economic damages, they're by their very nature, and by definition, they're non-economic. You have to build a construct for the jurors to appreciate what that looks like. You have to why things like the want ad, or, you know, talking about this in terms of a new job or things like that. I mean, these are all efforts to, or even a per diem type argument. These are all different ways to create a construct so that regular people can start thinking about economics in a non-economic situation. I mean, we don't say somebody has a $50 headache. No, that's a $300 headache, right? I mean, that's not the way we normally talk outside of a courtroom. We don't talk about pain in terms of money anywhere outside of a courtroom. So we're creating a construct, and that's both good news and bad news. Since you're creating a construct anyway, the limitations that people have are self-created limitations. They're based on what they believe, their construct that they're stuck in, right? It could be an appropriate construct, or it could be an inappropriate construct. Nonetheless, I think it's important. The first step here is to recognize that we're dealing with constructs. And so there's not necessarily a right or wrong, but a lot of lawyers become self-limiting because they believe there's a range of value for a certain kind of a case that they've been taught to believe is true. And then it becomes self-perpetuating. That's what they ask juries for. That's what they ask the insurance company for. It becomes a way of being stuck where people don't even realize that they're stuck there. And you've heard me say this, and I say it as often as I can to lawyers. I say, you know, you want me to give you the keys to doubling the value of your next case? Ask for twice as much. Ask for four times as much. I mean, get out of the paradigm that you're stuck in. Go through the struggle of asking yourself, why is this wrong? And I think what you're going to find is the only internal dialogue that says this is wrong or this is too much is the construct that you're stuck in. I mean, you have a belief that a broken arm case is worth between X and Y. So when you get Y, you walk around feeling awesome. Hey, man, I got the high end of the range. Well, it's only the high end of the range because you define the range where it is. What if we set that number that you just got at the low end of the range and you shoot for three times that amount? Well, you might not get three times that amount, but you might get twice that amount. And now you're retraining yourself on what that value and everybody else on what that value proposition is. That's why we're in the position we're in now as plaintiffs lawyers in the country where, you know, some people, including me, I mean, I think we're reaching some levels in some kind of cases that are unsustainable. Nine-figure results in single event cases are, I applaud them like we all do on our side, but it's hard to sustain those. If that became the norm, I'm not sure our economy could sustain those.
TLU Huntington Beach is going to be the greatest trial lawyers event in history. It all starts off on Tuesday, June 2nd with a dinner hosted by Finch at the Larea. We're buying it out and the pool area around it for our 300 of our closest friends. Wednesday, we're just doing workshops. We got Ben Rabinowitz and Mike Kelly doing expert cross. We got Philip Miller, Ed Sarambulli teaching advanced deposition. And we got six more workshops besides that. But if you're not interested in training that day, that afternoon, you can go out with Ted B. Wacker and go for the first annual TLU golf tournament, or racing go-karts with Kurt Zahner, or playing pickleball with Supio. That evening, we got the opening party. We got the lobby lounge at night with ping pong, foosball, DJ, and open bar. And then Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we got five lecture tracks, eight workshop tracks, full breakfast for everybody every morning on the ocean lawn for 700 people. Great lunches every day. This is our fifth year at the Paseo. The food's amazing. Ask anybody who's got the best food on the conference tour. It's TLU. Then Thursday night, we're buying out the Larea and the treehouse above it and doing a party hosted by Supio. That's going to be an 80s tracksuit party. Friday night, we're having the first ever Satch Oliver Wild West party. Satch is bringing 500 pounds of Angus beef. We're going to be grilling out. We're going to have a mechanical bull. It's going to be a great time. Lots of new friends being made. And finally, on Saturday, we're closing out the socializing with the Après Ski Adult Swim Pool Party. That's on Saturday night. Finally, but that's not it, though. Sunday morning, we're starting with connections and a great meal, and we're ending it. Sunday morning, we're having brunch with Scott Frost from the Frost Law Group, hosting our brunch on Sunday morning. So we're beginning with an ending with community and great learning. So TLU Huntington Beach, June 2nd through 7th. Be there. We'll see ya. I don't think it'll be the norm, and I think most of us get chopped down a bit by the judges and the courts and to keep the economy in somewhat balance, right? That's why, you know, great settlements like the one that we're about to talk about are a great thing because it's an agreement. It's not like some jury said it. It's like, hey, the insurance company and the truck company and you all agreed this is the settlement and shake hands and move forward. Let's move to that one because I know that was a result that you're pretty proud of and rightfully so, the result. I mean, it's tragic, right?
Unfortunately, there's a lot of confidentiality around it because that's what happens with big numbers usually. We try to keep things not confidential, but the other side ultimately wants it confidential. And then if you really think about it, you know, when you get to big enough numbers, it's probably better for your own client for a lot of those numbers to be confidential, at least to protect them from
their family members.
Lots of friends who come out of the woodwork and
they forgot they had.
In some cases, even these days, protect them from what might happen with ICE or things along those lines. I just had a case that we were forced to settle on the eve of trial, the week before trial, because the family could not deal with the stress of going, they were undocumented. And I had to resolve a case for what feels like 10 or 15 cents on the dollar because they wouldn't go to court. And even once I fixed that and said, well, we'll do it by Zoom, which is far from ideal, but more ideal than not showing up for trial, they still were worried. They thought their result, if we went and got a $50 or $60 million result, that ICE would be after them.
I'm sure Trump would have made a big deal of it. He's an undocumented worker coming and taking advantage of our insurance companies.
You know, I said, look, I don't want that to happen. If you have to leave the country with $50 million, you're probably okay. You can buy your other country for that, right? They didn't see it that way. And ultimately, we had to accept an offer that I thought was way too low. That's happening more and more. People need to understand, we lawyers need to understand that there's a population of people in the United States right now who are living in abject fear of being able to participate fully in our system. And if you're not talking to them about that, and they're not talking to you about that, you should bring it up. It's a big issue, and I don't think it's going away anytime soon. We always had issues with, you know, how do you deal with at trial, legal status, and all those kind of things, but it's at a different place now, I think. If they have young children, then it's a scary time for a lot of people. Jumping into this case, I'm not going to identify the defendants in the case. I will tell you that it was a case that involved sort of on the surface level, there was a trucking company, and then we were also saying that there were other people in addition to that initial trucking company who were responsible for the crash because the initial trucking company, basically there were two other trucking companies really because of the way it worked. Both of them together only had a couple million dollars in coverage.
Where'd you find the rest of the coverage or the rest of the money?
So again, with being careful not to breach confidentiality, I mean, in today's day and age, because of a number of things that have happened over, let's say, the last 5 or 6 years in trucking, one of the very common sort of scenarios that you have is you will look at a wreck report and you'll look at a set of facts and you'll see, okay, here's a driver and they're working for this motor carrier and you go through the process of getting the insurance for that motor carrier. And there's $1 million or $2 million or whatever in coverage or $750 in coverage, which is the minimum federal side. And still what I see is most lawyers don't look beyond that. They don't know how to, they don't appreciate. And that's really where the difference between learning how to do trucking. One of the big things that you're learning is that the transportation cycle that involves commercial trucking is interesting and it's different than what most people understand. And there's all kinds of different players who may be involved in that. And if you have a case where you have catastrophic injuries or death and you have insurance limits that don't satisfy the case, then one of the biggest things that we're having to do, and for years, this is where our value play really came in as lawyers, was to be able to come in those situations and find another avenue of coverage. And sometimes it was finding it through a trailer and finding out how to figure out how to attach, you know, the insurance from a trailer or a chassis or a dolly or something like that to a case. Oftentimes, though, it's looking for other parties who may also have responsibility. And so in this case, that's what happened. We had a situation where you have a 10-month-old child who becomes an incomplete quadriplegic at age 10 months old. By the time trial, you know, case got pushed really hard to get to trial, but the child was 3 years old, getting ready to go into trial. And she was essentially paralyzed from, think of the chest bone down. She is one of the cutest little things you've ever seen. in the world. There were all kinds of challenges with the family, though. We had a mother who had a history of being somewhat irresponsible, frankly, 16 years old at the time of the crash. The crash happens at 3 o'clock in the morning. She's out with her baby at 3 o'clock in the morning. There were all kinds of issues about whether the child was properly restrained or not in the vehicle, those kind of things. The child actually got taken away from the mom by DFACS at the hospital because of the wreck. So there were all kinds of challenges in the case. Yeah, this was a case Joe Camerlingo and I handled together. This was a case where it was no holds barred. This is one of those cases that becomes a full-time job. Interestingly, this was a case that was scheduled for trial in December. I think I started our discussion today saying I was on these back-to-back calendars. We thought all the time this case was going to settle, and then it didn't. And so we were right up against the trial. And it's sort of like almost like in a situation where you're driving down the road and a truck moves out of the way and suddenly you see the hazard. That's what happened in this case because we were so focused on other cases that were getting ready to go to trial and then had to flip into this one and make sure it got put together as cleanly as possible. So I don't know what else you want me to talk about the case, but I mean, from a value perspective in this case, this is a case that got resolved for just under $100 million.
How much of that was the life care plan for this child?
The life care plan, I believe, was, depending on which version of it you believed, was somewhere in the $30 million range. This was interesting because, you know, lots of things drive value and drive value decision-making in the case. I believe the value of this case was north of $100 million, significantly north of $100 million. If you take the liability risks out, which there were significant liability risks, this was a case just real quickly. I mean, our teenage mom driver was driving about under 15 miles an hour on a highway at 3 o'clock in the morning. She had a flat tire and along comes a truck and hits her from behind. But there are all kinds of peculiarities in the case. I mean, not the least of which is it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you have a young driver out there with her baby and everything that you might read into that. But then there were all kinds of peculiarities, like both the mom and the child were both found outside of the vehicle afterwards. But there really wasn't a mechanism for them to be ejected from the vehicle because of the way it happened. So there was all kinds of even confusion at the scene. How does this even happen? Mom had severely broken legs, so she couldn't have gotten out of the vehicle. She couldn't have taken the baby out of the vehicle. But I mean, it was just really, really messy, the facts. And there wasn't any way to resolve that messiness, right? Because there weren't witnesses or even experts who could really definitively answer the questions. They would get to a point where they're just scratching their head. You know, what experience shows us is that the weirder the facts are, it always works against the plaintiff, right? Because we have the burden of proof and we're asking for a lot of money. So jurors, I think, need to be able to, you know, pull the dots together or else they feel like you haven't met your burden of proof. And so you have to be really careful in those kinds of situations. But going back to the value side of this case, I mean, we had a $30 million or so life care plan. You got a long lifetime where this young girl needs to be taken care of. So it's easy to, and then you've got the non-economics, right? So it's easy to go ask for millions and millions of dollars a year in a case like that for someone who has become, at 10 months old, an incomplete quadriplegic. The problem is the venue that we were in has never allowed, the appellate courts have never allowed a nine-figure verdict in a single event case to stand. They've always found a way to undo it. Those kind of things start to weigh. So even once you get past the insurance company or you get them thinking about big numbers, there are sometimes in cases, there are upper limits that you have to start to consider from an appeals perspective. And this was that case. I think that if we tried that case, if we got by liability, it would have been a $200 million case. But it was also a case where just literally a couple of weeks before trial, the offer was less than $10 million because of the liability issues. And so the lesson that comes from that, I think everybody has heard a million times, but people seem to forget. And that's the best numbers come when the actual fear of trial is upon everybody. You know, so those lawyers, and there are lots of them out there, I used to be one of them, that would stomp my feet at the end of a mediation and be pissed off that they didn't offer me what I wanted. You should really just be smiling. You really have to be thinking about mediation as a stepping stone, as the beginning of a negotiation, not where the end of a negotiation happens. Almost always, there's exceptions to that, but almost always that's the case. Almost always there's more money coming if you stay the course and you show them that you're willing to go to the trial. That's why even that case we talked about, the Virginia case, you just got to go to trial. I mean, you got to show them you're the lawyer who will take the case to trial. And that scares them more than anything else I know.
That is the, but you know, and also obviously being in trial and having some results You know, because people just want to go to talk about going to trial, but they don't want to train to get ready for trial. They just think somehow because they're a lawyer, they're just going to beat themselves up there that it's all just going to flow until they get there. And then they realize, you know, the commitment, the time, the stress, and really the nerves that affect every human being up there. You know, when there's all that money, all that pressure on the line, without training, most people just don't perform. It's like you want to just become a professional. You want to be a quarterback in a real football game. Forget about the NFL, even like a lower level game, but you don't want to actually get up there and take passes and throw passes. You just want to study the playbook. That's most lawyers just want to study the playbook and don't actually practice the skills of presenting and connecting with the jury. And so that's something that, you know, people got to do if they want to go to trial. They got to get ready. Get yourself ready. You know, that's why I started, you know, that's one of the reasons that motivated me besides the pandemic, you know, to do what I do is because I stuttered the first 6 months of being a lawyer, just in court, just talking to the court. Blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Because I know those nerves are real. This fear is real and people don't want to talk about it. Yet they just think it's going to disappear somehow when they step into the courtroom, which is the craziest thing ever.
There's a lot of ways that this discussion can go in that regard. I agree. I mean, being a trial lawyer, being like many other professions, is an exercise in fear management at some level. I mean, I don't think you really want the fear to go away entirely. I think you want to use it as a catapult to other things. But at the same time, I totally agree with you that this is a skill. I don't think anybody would say, I'm going to get up and try to, I'm going to recite a poem. Let's just get something even simpler than a trial. I'm going to recite a poem to a room full of strangers. I'm never going to practice doing that ever before I do it. You know, I mean, like for most people, I think they would at least agree it's not going to be their best performance if they did that. And now add to that, that we're charged with a pretty heavy thing. I mean, somebody came and hired you to be their voice, to be their advocate, to make justice happen for them. I think, like, shame on you if you don't do everything you can to prepare yourself to be the best advocate. I hope you feel the weight of it. It's not just, oh, gee, I got this great case. What the hell are you going to do with it? I mean, if this was your favorite person in the whole world, would you want you representing them, right? Or would you want the person who's, I think the other thing, and I think you would agree with this, it's not, becoming a trial lawyer is not a once and done thing. Even the training that you get. I mean, some people say, well, you know, I was on my advocacy team in school. Great. That's a great first start. Do you really feel competent to go and direct and cross and do all the things that need to be done? Before that, understanding the strategies that you can only really understand. And I don't mean only strategies in terms of like legal strategies. I mean, communication strategies, like to have a plan of how you're going to approach a witness and how do you want to present? What do you want to look like up there? A lot of lawyers don't appreciate it. And then what happens in my experience, Dan, is that you don't do it for a few years. Like you get a few years in, then the fear, then it's like, shit, I'm not even sure I know how to put a photograph into evidence. I also feel shame around that. And so I'm not going to own that I just got to almost become the faker and I'm just going to fake it from here on out because I don't want anybody to know. And the reality is we have people who come to TLU, we make it safe to say, I don't know. And we make it safe to say, and even if you think you know, you may not know, by the way, right? So I guess what I'm trying to say is it's a light. Hopefully, people who are doing this for a living, this is what you want to be. They call it practicing law for a reason. Practice. Become better. I mean, I've been doing this for 30 plus years. I've got a lot of trials. I still think there's another level for me. So I want to keep pushing, keep learning.
There better be. So what makes it fun, too, is the continued growth. If you peaked out, well, what fun would it be if you weren't always trying to get better?
I agree. What I'm trying to do is encourage people who might listen to this, who might be in that camp, who have allowed themselves to fall into a place where, well, I just haven't done it, so it's too late for me. We've got people who have come through some of the trainings that you and I have done who are first trial in their 60s. They have to suck all that up and come in, be with a bunch of young kids, whippersnappers, and not feel like they know what they're doing. To see them afterwards when they go and they do something out in the world and they come back and they go, that was awesome. I didn't think I could do it, right? And they can, because that's the other thing about trial work is if you do the work, it's not rocket science, but you can get, I mean, dramatically better just with even a little bit of training. You can become dramatically better at communicating and doing this thing called trial.
I'm Orlando Di Castroverde. I've been a subscriber to TLU On Demand ever since the start. Anytime I listen to a particular episode that's relevant to a case that I'm working on, right away, I'm sharing it with my team, saying, hey, you got to listen to this. If you want to be the best trial lawyer that you can be, sign up for TLU On Demand today.
I'm doing a boot camp before the TLU beach at my Hermosa house, and one of the guys coming is 75 years old. And I told him, I said, man, I am working with you as much as we need to work together, because this is going to be a transformative experience for you. Because the fact that you're 75, but you're still that hungry to work this hard, to learn these new skills, it hasn't been easy. We've been working hard because, you know, it's just like, the reality is when we get older, there is cognitive decline in every one of us. Whether you're a professional athlete or you're an engineer or an accountant or a lawyer, in some way, I mean, that you have to figure out how to train around and take into account that doesn't work as fast as it used to, just like our bodies aren't as strong as they were when we were 30. But
it does. It doesn't mean that you can't be even more effective than when you were cognitively fully in 150%. You have to learn how to own where you are and take it from there. There's going to be improvement opportunities. Here's the reality in my experience, and I think you'll agree with this. Most lawyers, even people who profess to be trial lawyers, they've never been really trained. They've never, ever actually been trained. I remember Jerry Spence one time. I was getting ready to try a case. It was kind of like a career early case for me. California was going to be a long trial, and I had this kind of famous defense guy against me. I remember him coming up to me and kind of putting his big arms on my shoulders and looking at me and saying, you know, I hear you got this big case coming. I said, yes, sir. And he said, you know, I hear this guy who's trying the case against you has been practicing law for 50 plus years. I said, yes, sir. He goes, I know a little bit about that. I said, yes, sir. And he said, let me tell you, most lawyers, even trial lawyers with 50 years, they don't actually have 50 years of experience. They have 1 year of experience repeated 50 times. And I thought that was very insightful, because what he was telling me was most lawyers do something once, and then they rinse and repeat it. I mean, I don't care if you file a complaint, you got your complaint, you just change the names for the next complaint. You've deposed a neuropsychologist once, you're deposing them again, you pull your outline out from the last one, you make a few tweaks, and voir dire. Most trial lawyers, they have the same damn voir dire every time. They just change, you know, a few points. Opening follows the same exact. So we're creatures of habit, and just like all human beings. But the good news and bad news of that is that there are patterns that make sense, and that if you don't like the pattern you're in, if we can open your eyes to, you know, I'm always talking about shifting the paradigm, that's my word, but that's a paradigm shift. If we can open your eyes and you can say, oh shit, I didn't know that I could do that. I'm sure when you do some of your presentation skills work, it's the first time people have ever even contemplated or thought about where their eyes are looking when they're talking about something. What's going on with their hands? How do they interact with a board? Right now, they just do it. There's no consciousness to the process. And once there is consciousness to the process, now we have opportunities, right? Now you can say, okay, wait, well, shit, there's a million ways we can do this. Let's figure out for the particular lawyer, what's the best one? And for someone who's 75 years old, it may be different than for somebody who's 25 years old. For women, it may be very different than for men in terms of what is the best way to approach something. So I don't think it's even a one-size-fits-all scenario. Anyway, I've rambled. What I'm hoping is that there's somebody out there who needs to hear this and who will take a deep breath and say, yeah, despite my feelings about how I am and where I am right now, I do want to get better at this. And that's what this whole thing's for. And I just want you to know that it's a safe place, because you would be, whether you come to a small program or the big program, you're coming to a place of like-minded people who have all felt that same way. And who are, it's not a show-off place. It's not a place where somebody's swinging around saying, I'm the best. What you'll see is people who you think are the best who are still working on becoming better. And I think that's what makes it so special is, you know, you got very top of the ladder of people who are still looking in the other room and saying, I'm here to teach, but I'm also here to learn. When you teach that 75-year-old, Dan Ambrose, you're going to learn from the 75-year-old too, right?
Always learning is patience when I'm teaching too, and being a better teacher, because like thinking, okay, my only job is to make this person better. That's it. Nothing else matters. To be able to communicate with this individual so they understand the concepts and skills that they need to, you know, they need to adopt and learn, and help them to control their facial expressions. Most people never thought, what's going on with their face when they're talking to people? It makes a difference. You look like this if you have a relaxed face and some warmth, you know, when you say hi to somebody, but your face just naturally warms up unconsciously. Or you say good morning to people. But when you're in the pressure of trial, it's like you look like you're, most people are stressed.
Well, what happens when you're in the pressure of trial, you fall to your defaults. And what if you've never actually even looked at any of the defaults? Like you've never consciously. What I'm trying to suggest to people is that you can keep getting better and better from wherever you are. There's always a path forward. TLU is a great place to do that because it's a safe place to do it. I think a lot of people get stuck in a place where they don't know there's a place they can go and just say, look, I don't feel like I know what the hell I'm doing and I just need help. You know, my hope is that that will invigorate some people to come and to get excited again about the process of becoming a better and better trial lawyer, which in my experience, and I think yours too, Dan, it makes us better people overall. Learning how to communicate better with a jury also teaches you how to communicate better with your staff and with your people at home. And
that's why I tell people that come to my boot camps, I'm like, you have become great. The skills that you just started to learn, you need to practice them every day. Before you start talking to one of your staff members, you better think about eye contact and think about what's going on in your face. It matters in the connection. Same thing with your spouse or your family members. It's like learning these habits of mindfulness and intentionality with everything that goes on with our voice. And think about practicing speaking more slowly when you're trying to communicate, because the pressure of a courtroom speeds everybody up. And until you become intentional with your breathing. People stop breathing when they present. It's the craziest thing. They try to get like a 30-second statement out in one breath and their flesh falls off. You see the stress to their body because they're not breathing properly. I remember when I started working with our friend Dave Clark, you know, he said, when you can make the unconscious conscious, then you're going to be fucking dangerous.
That's actually what I was trying to find those words, is once people see this, it will make the unconscious conscious. They will suddenly go, oh my gosh, I never even considered X. Once you've considered it, you can't unsee it. It is conscious now. And sometimes that brings on some fear. It's like, oh, you know, or it also brings on some light bulb moments where people go, oh, maybe this is why I have trouble communicating with people, or this is why I'm misunderstood by people, or, you know, this is why, you know, blah, blah, blah. Hugely important is the recognition that this is a teachable skill. Everybody can get better. Some people have the natural, quote, gift of gab, and other people have more challenges with that. But everybody can continue to get better. To me, that's exciting.
No, it is exciting. And one place we're going to do that is at TLU Beach. And, you know, this is our fifth year doing it at the same hotel. And our third year in a row, we bought out the whole hotel. And, you know, I really am stoked for this year because, you know, every year, trimmed it down to one program a year. Although next year we're going to do two because we're going to do an advanced deposition program, you know, led by our friend Philip Miller. You know, I try to put it all into it, not just an educational, but an experience for people overall. We try to like raise the bar every year. And really, my goal is to people come leave it like, wow, that was an amazing experience. Not just the learning, but all the friends that they made, all the connections, and having a great time for 5 days. Because this is a tough job and it's a lonely job too. It's very lonely. And to be able to, you know, most of us as we get older don't make a lot of new friends because there's just no time and commonality of interest. But on top of great learning, I try to make TLU really a friend machine because, and in this year, like we're doing on Tuesday night, here on Tuesday night, we're having a dinner party for everybody that's there, whether they're an attendee or an exhibitor. And so that way, and to sit down at, you know, buy out the entire restaurant and have the entire restaurant at the hotel. The Luray is a great restaurant to ourselves. And you know, I'm even going to give people, you know, we do our personal bios. So whoever's sitting at your table, you're going to have their bios before you get there, kind of know who you're sitting with and really start to build connections before we even start it, just to create a more robust program. And, you know, I love my theme parties and you've also agreed. I got, wait till you see it. We're just designing, Noelle's designing your tracksuits going into the printer. You're going to be very excited. The Free Goldberg, Joe Freed tracksuit. So, and the most part starts with the education at TLU, and you're teaching quite a bit this year. As we always do, we put you to work. This is no vacation for you.
Right. Like you go home, you now have a community of people you're going to be interacting with that you didn't before, that you can ask questions to, that you can learn from, that you know are like-minded to you. So I think it's super important. But yeah, let's talk about content because you got me working my ass off on this.
That's right. So on Wednesday, it's just workshops. So you have Wednesday off. So you're going to get to be able to enjoy, you know, Wednesday. There's going to be 8 workshops on Wednesday. None of those you're teaching. You're taking the day off, getting ready. But Wednesday afternoon, there is a golf outing. I know you don't have time for golf, because neither do I, but a lot of people like golf. So I thought we'd accommodate our golfers. Ted Wacker's hosting that. And there's also pickleball. And our friend Kurt Zander's taking people out go-kart racing. Then, you know, we have our little opening party. And, you know, this year, too, we're going to have a poker tournament every night in the presidential suite. Besides our lobby lounge, you know, with the ping pong tables and my nephew Harrison, DJ at Beach and me being the DJ. I got an official DJ booth this year. We're always stepping up our game.
He's actually a really good DJ. I've seen his work before, and you know, he jokes around a lot, but when he gets on there being a DJ, he's damn serious and he does a good job. I know he is.
I said, it's a good thing you don't make a lot of money because you probably just move to Ibiza for a few years. He's like, hell yeah, I would. I'll come back when I'm 35 and be a lawyer, but I want to go be a DJ rock star for a few years. I'm like, I wouldn't blame you. You know, I can understand that.
I wanted people to know he's serious about it. It's not just a play game for him. He's really good.
Yeah, well, he'll appreciate you saying that because he takes a lot of pride in his DJing. But Thursday morning, you and our good friend Satch Oliver. Oh, yeah, we're having on Friday. We're having the Satch Oliver Wild West party. So he's bringing 500 pounds of Oliver Angus beef. And he's like, I got to have a wood fire grill, Dan. Don't be giving me no gas grill for my beef. I said, okay, Satch. And we're going to have a mechanical bull, too. So Satch can show off his rodeo skills on the mechanical bull if he wants to. I don't think you should do that after age 40, but that's just my general. I'm getting older. Don't do silly stuff like ride mechanical bulls.
I think I'd like to bring a blow up trial exhibit of a release form. And we can have him sign that release before he gets on that bull. Let's jump in because I know we're both running a little bit. Yeah, so Thursday morning, Satch and I are going to spend 3 hours. I love teaching with Satch. He pushes me and I push him. If you look at Depositions or Trial, you'll see a lot of stuff that I think it would somewhat influenced by me. And if you look at Speed Trial, you see things have been influenced by Satch and we continue to collaborate and think about it. But historically, what struck us recently was that when we've presented on this in the past, we have focused on cases that are, frankly, huge trucking cases. You know, nine-figure result of Satch's or some nine-figure result of mine. I had somebody come up to me and gently remind me that I think the way he said it was mere mortals out here are not handling nine-figure cases regularly. And look at all this effort that goes in. That's hard to do when it's not a nine-figure case or an eight-figure case. I talked to Satch about that, and we agreed that what we would do this year was really try to bring these concepts that we've been teaching for big cases, but bring them down to, quote, regular cases, you know, regular trucking cases. So we're going to be focused on those kinds of situations where the more typical truck crash cases and how do you apply the methodologies that he and I have worked on together for so long in those kind of cases over a 3-hour time period. That's what Thursday morning is. Friday morning, I am going to do 3 hours myself where I'm going to sort of provide my updated thoughts on Speed Trial. It'll have a trucking bend to it, but frankly, it's designed for anybody and anybody would benefit from this. Some parts of it will have to do with liability and how thoughts on that side, things that you've heard me talk about before, reducing things to binary sort of light switch concepts, but then also a lot of damages materials, a lot of things to do from a damages perspective on Speed Trial, new thoughts on damages presentations. So that's going to be my 3 hours on Friday. And then on Saturday, I'm doing sort of, you've got me multitasking for the first hour. I'm going to be doing a presentation on connecting with witnesses. That's part of the program that Phil Miller is doing. It's really a mastermind kind of boot camp kind of on deposition skills. And you know, part of the idea of depositions is to bring intentionality to how do you want to connect with the witness. I'm going to spend a little time talking to you. I think it's about 45 minutes or so talking about that. And then I'm going to disappear from that room and go back into the room with Joe Camerlingo, where together we are presenting a one-day sort of mastermind trucking that really is designed to take people, even if you have no trucking background at all, really kind of make sure we're going to cover the basics. We're going to do some more advanced stuff too, but we're going to cover the basics. And then we're going to pick a few cases that we feel are representative from people who are attendees. We're going to ask for that in advance. So if you do come to this, we're going to ask you to the next two Wednesdays, Wednesday next week and Wednesday the following week, we're going to ask you to spend about an hour to an hour and a half with us so that we can build this community for us to get to know exactly what you need from this program and then to help us pick a couple of cases from what you have to be teaching cases for the afternoon part of the program, which we'll pick probably three cases and use those three cases to be the springboard to teach people how to work up cases from the beginning, what to be thinking about in them, how to make sure that you know where all the coverages are, you know all the potential players are, you know all the potential rules and causes of action, then how to limit those down a la Speed Trial into being the most effective that you can be in the preparation of those cases. And then we'll take what Joe and I call sort of the value adders to these cases, you know, what most people think about when they see a truck case to where do we see value adds? how to do that in these cases. And then the afternoon, we'll be taking those three cases from people who are attendees, taking what we've learned in the morning and applying it to actual real world facts in the afternoon. Joe and I have also committed to anybody who is part of our specific program, we will help make some time for you privately if you feel a specific need. That's why we need to know what you want out of the program. If we can address those things in the group and there's enough people who need that, then that's what we'll be focused on. But if there are individual things that you need for your case that you feel stuck about, one or both of us will make ourselves available to you. We'll figure out how to do that, whether it's a TLU or even if necessary, jump on a Zoom afterwards. We really want to provide value to the people who are in the group. That's what you've got me doing out there, and I'm working diligently to get ready for it.
December 8th through 12th, you and Joe are teaming up again, and we're going to do another trucking boot camp like we did last August at the Paseo Hotel. We had about 15 participants. It was great. It was a five-day program where you spent an hour each morning with each group and an hour each afternoon with each group, because there was three groups. So you had, and we kept the groups together, so you'd help them with their trucking cases. And the time they weren't working with you, they are working with myself and my other coaches on developing their performance skills, their cross-examination skills, their witness prep, their, you know, presentation skills, you know, they use in opening and closing. And so that program was one of my favorite programs ever, just because of like the community, the size, the work that was being done, the focus, people working on their cases and working on their skills.
That's going to be great. I mean, it really was nice last time, because what it allowed, you know, it was already a small group by design. We capped it at 15 people. And I think we actually had a few who were on a waiting list that we couldn't get to. We on purpose didn't want to make it bigger than that, so that people have time when they're doing work with you. They actually have a lot of time on their feet, so much so that you're tapping out. You've got so much time. You're on your feet doing the work on that side. But it also, what it allows me to do is really, before that ever happens, we have a couple of sessions where I get to know, what are the one or two cases that you've got concerns about, or what are the one or two skill sets that you really want to work on as a truck lawyer specifically? What are the things that will advance your ball personally? And then in small group settings, I get to put that together and really work with people on specific cases, on their specific things that they need themselves. It's a way for, and this time I get to do that with my great friend and colleague, Joe Camerlingo. We do a lot of cases together. We're partners in the Florida law firm together. He's a fantastic lawyer. It will be an intense few days, that's for sure. Both you'll, about the time you're done working on trucking for a little while, we're not overloading you each day on content. It's a split between content and on your feet work, presentation skills. If you really want to spend some intense time doing that, be on your feet, literally. But I bet by the time between the two sessions, I bet you're on your feet at least an hour a day, yourself, you. You can't hide in this program. You come prepared to work. You're working in the evenings, getting ready for the next day. It's an intense thing to go through, but I still am communicating with people from last year on it regularly. Like, we text together, we help them on cases. One case I'm doing with one of the guys who was there that we've agreed to team up on. Not every one of them am I in touch with, but more than half of the people who were in the program last year, I'm communicating with regularly. So they've become friends and I'm helping them and they help me.
Me too. I've been in touch with most all of them. I talk to them and check in and see how they're doing. And a lot of them will be back at TLU Beach. Some won't, because they have young kids. Like, you know, I started a new job. I can't get them. Like, all right, next year, buddy. Let me give you the date so you don't miss it. Something to plan around. All right, Joe Freed, what's going on down there in Florida? You just taking a little time off, or?
Well, I'm with my wife down here. We bought a house a few years ago in Sarasota area. The hurricanes took it out. We're finally, hopefully, getting close to being able to be spending some time back in Sarasota, which I'm looking forward to. So,
well, that's what's nice about Southern California. We don't have hurricanes.
Yeah. And you have less bugs and less humidity. You got other problems, but we won't talk about those right now.
Okay. Sounds good. All right, Joe. Thanks. I'll see you in about 19 days from today. So by the time this gets published, it'll probably be 12 days from today. So thanks, Joe. Have a great one. Bye-bye.
Appreciate you. Thanks a lot.
Ready to train with the Titans and set records with your verdicts? Register for our live conferences and boot camps at triallawyersuniversity.com. Start getting your reps in before the big event by going to tluondemand.com to gain instant access to live lectures, case analysis, and skills training videos from the trial lawyer champions you love and respect, as well as pleadings, transcripts, PowerPoints, and notes for a roadmap to victory. Join the group that continues to get extraordinary results. Trial Lawyers University, produced and powered by Law Pods.